You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's program, with the effects of economic chaos in China rippling around the world and tumbling oil prices, is the global economy due for another rough patch? I'll have that debate with my special guests Roger Boyce from the Times of London and Peter Fleming from Cass Business School. Then we'll take a look at the future of politics in Greece. We'll ask why Germany needs young people, discover why Lebanon is buried in burning rubbish, and find out why Russia is banning foreign washing powder. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. So welcome to today's program. My guests are longtime foreign correspondent Roger Boyce, diplomatic editor at the Times of London, and Peter Fleming, professor of business and society at Cass Business School and author of the new book, The Mythology of Work. Welcome both to the program. Let's start today's chat with a health check of the global economy. China cut its main interest rate today to boost growth in its economy. This trick is working for now. Global markets have surged after this interest cut. This was the fifth time interest rates were cut since November last year. Well, just yesterday, hundreds of billions were wiped off world's financial markets as the so-called China's Black Monday sent shares tumbling around the world. Peter, if I start with you first, should we gradually start being more concerned about China and less about Greece?
China has been in slow decline for about the last 5 years. So it peaked in terms of growth in 2010 and has been slowly declining in its economic output. So I think we need to see the big picture here, that this Black Monday is part of a bigger story. Whether it is going to happen again and whether it's a taste of things to come, everyone's speculating on that very, very topic. But certainly the markets have bounced back in the UK and the US. So for now, things seem not too bad for the global economy.
Roger, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I sort of take that view too, that it's not apocalypse now. Rather, it's probably to do with August volatility, when all the serious people who can say, calm down, this is all part of something, part of a process, a shift away from export-led economy to fostering domestic growth, all these kind of things, are all away on holiday and on beaches and they can't come back. So it's part of that. But of course, there are some really important structural problems. And I think it is a wake-up call for those few people who aren't on the beach. It is actually quite shocking to realize that these that the Chinese economy is in the hands of actually rather incompetent apparatchiks who don't know how to deal with state monopolies, who don't know when to intervene in markets and when not, and who have been regularly massaging growth figures. So all of these things make for quite a big wobble, since China, unlike Greece, for example, has pervaded the whole of the global economy. There's not an economy in Africa that's not affected by what happens in China. It's everywhere.
And Roger, what is your impression? How reliable is the information and numbers we get of the state of the Chinese economy anyway?
Well, there was an economist who is now coincidentally prime minister who said a few years ago, don't count on the official GDP figures. They're unreliable. They're made by humans, which is a pretty, pretty trenchant comment. And he said, keep an eye instead on railway freight figures, keep an eye on electricity usage. And he gave a number of other interesting micro indicators that you should watch to see if the economy is slowing down or not. And indeed, if you do study railway freight over the last 6 months, you'll see that the economy is slowing down massively. So the thing is, you have these former communist apparatchiks who have this kind of state capitalism going on, and who've come from a whole culture of saying that there should be a certain growth figure and expecting everyone down below to produce the result which matches what they want, which in this case was 7%, and a reality where you're trying to let more markets into the system, and in fact, you're nowhere near 7%, and no one dares admit it. So it's, you know, emperor without clothes situation.
Peter, it became clear, well, it's been for quite some time already, how dependent we are on the economic performance of China, and it's hard to be less dependent. What should be the lesson learned from yesterday?
First of all, debt isn't simply a problem in the West. It's an endemic problem in the global economic system, right throughout the system. This is a story about debt that is probably in many ways very similar to what happened in 2008 in Western economies, by the way, which China was pretty much largely survived untouched with the 2008 crisis. So I think and you know this keys into the story about Greece as well and what's happening in the EU. I think we need to really start thinking about this debt-fueled approach to economic management that seems to be so pervasive and entrenched.
What does that actually mean in reality?
Well, that means going with something that China's announced today, going back to the real economy, going back to things that actually work and that actually are material, rather than having this kind of very fickle, very volatile financial industry that can suddenly collapse overnight, as we've seen in the past.
Roger, when you spoke just a moment ago, I got the impression that you didn't have that much trust on the knowledge and expertise when it comes to the Chinese government, when it comes to dealing with these economic issues. Do you think they are learning lessons from elsewhere?
Yes, I mean, of course, this by emphasizing the lack of trust, I was just explaining why this crisis arose in the first place. It was suddenly a loss of confidence in the Chinese government to handle everything. They are learning from all sorts of places, but there are also things that we've overlooked and that have always been there. I remember going to Macau last year and going to one of these really naff casinos, the Venice, I think it was, you know, kind of Las Vegas lookalike. And it was full. There was a central gambling hall with about maybe 1,000, 1,500 people, all mainland Chinese, all dressed like villagers in kind of shell suits and things. And all, as I found out to my horror, gambling at $1,000 a chip. And you wonder, and chain smoking, you know, so, I mean, you know, just to shock the audience even more. But it was. I thought, my God, you know, we've accepted as a premise all the time that actually the Chinese government, the Chinese leadership is risk averse. But you forget what an incredibly risk-prone and gambling streak there is in the Chinese character, and where does it end? You know, what level? And you know, so there's an awful lot we don't know culturally about the decisions that are being made in China on really quite critical things, which now affect all of us.
So, how do you see the economic future of China?
Well, I mean, there are people saying it's not going to survive because there is no future in this kind of state-run capitalism. You have to allow the markets to breathe and to function at their own levels. And this was the reason, you know, that we're in this situation, that the Chinese government wanted to devalue, and it seems to me quite legitimate. You know, their exports are falling. Why not devalue? And then suddenly they lost control. They panicked because they thought the yuan was dropping even further than it should. So my feeling is, yes, it will grow. It will grow psychologically, but it's maybe grown too fast and now has to consolidate and think again about where it's going.
Peter, do you agree?
I think that we ought to be really worried about the Asia-Pacific area more generally. So economies like Australia, for example, where I lived for 5 years, were wholly dependent on the steel market and the commodities market. New Zealand as well, in terms of the dairy produce. So I think these economies are going to hurt. I think China is big enough to take the slack for a while and kind of recover. I'm not too sure if it's anything to do necessarily with the Chinese mentality. I think that this we need to look broader about the way in which the global economic system more generally is set up. I'm not too sure if it's simply because of the Chinese cultural traits and how they deal with economic management.
Peter and Roger, let's leave China now and let's continue to Greece, where Syriza party seems to be very confident about its future. A senior member of the party said today in an interview that Syriza can win re-election with an outright majority. Panos Skourletis, energy minister in the Syriza-led government, which resigned last week, also said that the nation must avoid deadlock leading to a second round of elections. Greece's president has asked two opposition parties to try to form a new government after Prime Minister Tsipras quit on Thursday last week. Roger, are you as confident about Syriza's ongoing popularity as this politician in question?
Well, I think, you know, the narrative of Syriza is this constant overestimation of its abilities and its brinkmanship. Plus, you know, they're heading for an election, so of course you say these things. But they're so confident, in fact, about their own abilities that there's now two of them, so, and both really confident about their future. So, and I think that's probably the, you know, populist parties follow this trend on the left and on the right. They split. They unite for a basic single cause. It might be immigration in the case of right-wing populists or whatever, but it's and in the case of, you know, in this case it was the bailout, and eventually they fall apart. They've got too narrow a base. The party structure itself is poor. It's not being built up organically, and frankly, if it doesn't, the legitimate question is not whether they're going to get an absolute majority. I don't think they are, but what happens next and who they could possibly form a coalition with. And the problem is that all the mainstream parties are pro bailout, and you know, and there are parties that just hate their guts. There's New Democracy, and I just can't see New Democracy going together with them and PASOK. So honestly, I don't see much of a future for Syriza. It might scrape through in this election, but I think, I mean, you can say this of all, you know, you look at the other left wing, Podemos is going to probably fall apart the closer it gets to power in Spain, and I would bet the Scottish Nationalist Party will also, after the elections next May, also start to split in different ways. So they're parties that reflect a certain moment and a certain issue, but then the terms of that issue change and the moment changes and they wither.
Looking at how the Greek public feels about Syriza party, Peter, when you think of all the campaign promises Syriza gave before the previous elections, and when you think of the performance of Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, if you draw from your experience and knowledge from, say, management skills, how well do you think, what kind of boss has Tsipras been?
Well, I was lucky enough to be in Greece, in Athens, during the referendum, by chance. And boy, they're really doing democracy hard. I haven't seen that much democracy being injected into a country, and which is really refreshing. I think that the party is probably over. I was shocked that I learnt today, and I don't know if this is true, that Varoufakis wasn't actually a member of the party, which tells you a little bit about their cohesion and their management of their solidarity. And it's fragile, and we also must remember that they got mauled. The party was mauled, and some would say very, very unfairly picked out by the EU and put up against the wall. And very few parties would survive such a mauling by such a powerful entity. And they've turned their back on the policies that they were elected to represent. So it's all a bit sad, to be honest. But at least there is a lot of democracy going on. So there's a little bit of hope there.
If I could just add to that, I wouldn't overrate the democratic credentials of that referendum. If you saw the ballot sheet with those two completely incomprehensible choices, which was cooked up within a week, you know, and the whole referendum was cooked up within a week. So there was in fact no real referendum campaign at all. So I think, you know, they're winging it. winging it, and it's not going to last.
Well, on a side note, it was reported some time ago, just a couple of days ago, that on Sunday, former finance minister Varoufakis met former French economy minister Arnaud Montebourg in France, and they seemed to share many ideas about Germany, which supposedly stifles growth in Europe due to an obsession with rules, inflation and debt. When we see these two characters getting together, do you get a feeling that there may be a wider statement against Germany?
Yes, certainly people are fed up with what they think Germany is trying to make them do. I don't know, there are so many streams now in Europe. There's an anti-austerity stream, which we can see in Britain is being exploited by the person who's most likely to be the future leader of the Labour Party. There's an anti-German stream, and there's an anti-immigrant stream. And these are the three great populist streams in Europe at the moment, and they're distorting politics and relationships between parties in quite a big way. Unfortunately, Germany gets the brunt of all of this, and sometimes deservedly so, and sometimes you think, oh, poor Germans. I mean, you know, you don't think that for very long, but it's nevertheless something that goes through your brain.
Peter, do you think it's fair how Germany is perceived at the moment?
I've spent a lot of time in Germany and the wonderful people. But what I notice when I've been in Athens is more of a sense of animosity towards Brussels and the EU as a whole, or its technocratic management elite as a whole, rather than Germany per se. But Germany's got the most stake in the debt that Greece owes now. So I think that the coming together of these two characters is interesting, because once again they're raising the issue of, you know, debt relief and restructuring this idea of debt and being a punitive use of debt to discipline certain political persuasions in the other countries. I think that's a really useful thing to rethink those issues.
Peter and Roger, let's take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and coming up next we hear of the paralysis of Lebanon's government, the future of young people in Germany, and how Russia seems to be banning all the foreign things it can think of. Stay tuned.
Join Monocle 24's international editors and correspondents as they touch down in a different city each week for our brilliant new travel program. Come on board for a one-stop audio guide to the most dynamic emerging cities around the world. The journey continues this week in Belgrade. As well as hospitality highlights and key cultural hotspots, we'll also visit new retail spaces, sample the local food scene, and meet the design denizens that a potentially time-poor traveller can ill afford to miss. The Voyager, in association with Turkish Airlines, is now boarding.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist, right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Peter Fleming, Professor of Business and Society at Cass Business School, and Roger Boyce, Diplomatic Editor at The Times of London. Let's turn now to Lebanon and the situation of political paralysis on that country. The powerful Hezbollah party and its Christian allies walks out of an emergency cabinet meeting today in protest at a proposed solution to a garbage disposal crisis that has ignited violent protests in Beirut. Earlier, 2 days of demonstrations descended into clashes in which dozens of protesters and police were hurt. Prime Minister Tamam Salam has appealed for calm and threatened to resign over the crisis. Roger, this unrest is about so much more than just garbage, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's good. I'm glad you said that, because I was worried you'd want me to analyse rubbish in Levantine rubbish. No, it's Lebanon is under immense strain, and in fact, all of these countries next to Syria, Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon, who've taken masses amounts of refugees, are under incredible financial strain and social strains. It's costing a lot of money. In particular, Lebanon's welfare network is very poor. It's kind of bursting at the seams. You know, there's I think it's almost the equivalent of a quarter of its population are now refugees. Well, you can't sustain that for very much longer. And the truth is that Hezbollah as a governing partner is useless. That's the other thing. It's dependent on subsidy and it's dependent on outside assistance, which it's getting declining amounts of. And we will see now what happens. It's be quite interesting with the new conciliation with Iran and Iran's previous support for the Hezbollah in all of its different manifold appearances, including in the Lebanese political class. And we'll see now whether Iran will try in some ways to make itself more attractive as an international actor and pulls the rug from underneath Hezbollah's feet, and Lebanon will look even wobblier than it is at the moment. It's extremely complex, but it's a very small state, very badly governed, very, very unstable at the moment.
Peter, Roger mentioned there how badly the country has been governed, and just one example is that it's been over 20 years since the end of the civil war, and the country still struggles with basic services, as we see even here now. How would you go and fix the situation?
Well, first of all, the first rule of municipal governance is, even before the sewer or the water, you make sure that the garbage isn't lying around, because it's so symptomatic of everything else. They've really kind of broken that rule, and they're getting the response from a concerned citizenry as a result. So, yeah, you've got to start with the basics, but it's difficult because that area of the world, following the Middle Eastern wars, is a mess. With all sorts of weird things happening at the moment, a lot of strain on governments, a lot of anxiety. So in that context, you can understand why things are coming apart at the seams in this particular way. But yes, get the basics correct right from the start.
Roger, do you see any solution to what we see happening in that country now?
The solution is that somehow we bring the Syrian war to an end, because it's the Syrian war that's toxic, and that's basically bringing all the neighbours to their knees. But having said that, it's not simple. There's not one war in Syria. There are about five. You know, there's Turkey versus the PKK, and there's, you know, I won't list them all because it will take too long. But basically, there are different wars, and therefore, it's almost resistant to normal diplomacy, because you can't solve five conflicts all at once, nor can you necessarily bomb five groups all at once. You have the mythos too of Islamic State, and the fear that this that then transcends all borders. So what you've got in Lebanon is a very shell-shocked population, really. You've got people, a lot of them are literally shell-shocked, of course. A lot of them are Syrian refugees trying to make ends meet, competing for water, competing for accommodation, and damaged, quite often damaged in different ways, psychologically too. The crime rate's gone up. And all of this is putting immense strain on a society that, you know, frankly, had problems supplying regular electricity and internet services even before the war. So you've got to get that war sorted out, and then the peripheral countries will benefit. But, you know, I'm glad I don't have that job.
Let's rush to Germany next, where the country's aging population is threatening Germany's position as the largest economy in Europe. According to the UN estimates, Germany's population is expected to decrease by 6 million people by 2050. The German finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble has admitted that demographic change is one of the great challenges the country is facing. Peter, when you look at the current discussion about migration to Europe, that all chaos, do you think this kind of news could make, say, the German public more approving of the idea of immigration and migration?
Well, one of the main solutions to the tax-based problem with an aging population is migration. So we have two kind of contradictory forces here. We've got an aging population and a lack of political will to support working parents. And this is a legacy in Germany. This is a legacy of years of neglect. You know, they got to that too late. And now it's been built into the culture that, you know, to have a child means you're going to be at a major disadvantage in every other facet of your life. And the same thing happening in the UK, of course. But at the same time, you know, one way to deal with, to get a more vibrant tax base is to open the borders and to be a little bit freer, which of course is a very unpopular thing in many parts of Germany and in Europe as well. So it's a tricky, tricky problem. There's an economic solution, but that is generally looked frowned upon within the political domain.
Roger, Germany is not the only European country facing the problem of an aging population. Do you think there are individual European countries that are actually doing a very good job that could work as an example of how to attract young people?
Well, I mean, there are countries in Europe that don't have a demographic problem in that way, and they're largely Catholic countries. That's traditionally been the case. Those Catholic countries that don't have an emigration culture, so Ireland, for example, has a high birth rate, but also a high emigration rate, so they haven't really solved anything. The problem would, on paper, economists love this dilemma, because on paper you've got immigrants who are quite often Muslim, and once they settle, I mean, in Berlin you see it, in Turkey there are a lot of Turkish Turks who keep their citizenship and who keep their obviously keep their religion, and who have an average of four children per family, as opposed to German inhabitants of Berlin who are struggling to produce 1.2. So it's immigration should be attractive, but what is happening is that it's actually extremely unattractive, and is actually forcing wages down and reinforcing this rather despairing, angstish attitude.
Peter, just quickly, what do you think, how important is it to have young, less experienced people at workplaces?
It's very important. You have a training set up in which we get younger people into the workforce and trained is very, very important. Other countries in Europe, there's that lack of that emphasis on training and apprenticeships and those sorts of things. But in Australia, I think they actually paid people when they had a baby, which is probably one of the most radical solutions I've seen to this problem. You can actually imagine a population explosion if we tried this in the UK or wherever.
Let's finish today in Russia, where Vladimir Putin seemingly can't stop himself from banning foreign products. We have seen foreign food imports get destroyed, and now apparently it's the turn of detergent and washing powder from overseas. Roger, do you see any logic to all of this, which products get banned over there?
Well, Yes, I mean, you want to. I think you're making a signal not just about evil capitalist West, and you're not just making a point. I mean, of course, a lot of people, because the ruble is so low, a lot of people are not buying these things anyway. Yes, yeah? So because they've become so expensive. But no, I mean, the main logic. Civilizational. It's saying Russia can do these things better than you can. You know, who needs French camembert? Russian camembert is brilliant. You know, and Russian washing powder, okay, it leaves you with a rash, but my God, it's good. You know, it's Russian. And it's just, you know, East versus West story.
Thank you very much. We'll have to leave it there, unfortunately, already. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. Thank you to my guests, Roger Boyce and Peter Fleming. Today's program was produced by Daniel Ciacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Federica Romaniello and Aidan McLaughlin, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, Chris Lord will keep you company with Monaco's international playlist. This program will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. For this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye and thank you for listening.